what is the history of church people and Indian people, and what can we learn from that? And there is a book recommended by the National Indian Lutheran Board, which is titled American Indians and Christian Missions. It is on order here at the bookstore, but it hasn't arrived yet. Then I began a 7-part session, and this is the 6th part. Now, out of this book, Now That the Buffalo's Gone, which is a study of today's American Indians, it's a new book, 1984 edition, by Alvin Joseph E. Jr. And before I get into today's discussion, which is the Great Northwest Fishing War, which you may have some things to talk about, I will do a little ad for the Holden Village Bookstore. And for yourselves, the subject that I've been working on, and one reason why I divided it up into 15 different sessions, is because the subject of Native Americans, their history, culture, concern, and religion, is so immense we could get a degree in it. And it's also very interesting, and I think a very important part of our American history. There are some things available here that if you're interested in Indians and the history or culture, religion, that are really good things to start with. This book, God is Red, by Vine Deloria Jr., came out about 9 years ago. And Vine Deloria went to Lutheran Seminary with a lot of our pastors, and so a lot of Lutherans know him. This is a book, I think, that is real important, especially for Lutherans and for all people, American people, too. I think this is an important book to read. It says here, Publishers Weekly, The Definitive Word on American Indian Affairs, a major contribution to today's religious and social thought. This is available. A large book is Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which we often recommend to people to begin a study of American Indians. Here at Holden, they have an adapted version that can be read quickly. This is recommended for reading, especially by the youth, but this is just Wounded Knee, an Indian History of the American West. This is for young readers. It is an adaptation of Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, written by Dee Brown. Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee is sort of the first text for people who are getting involved in the history of Indian people. This book, The Spiritual Legacy of the American Indian by Joseph Epps Brown. Have you met this person?
No, I
just wondered. I haven't either, but I certainly enjoyed the text. It's written by an Indian man, and it's really well done to get in depth an understanding of the spirituality, the spiritual strength of those Indian religions that are still ongoing. He is a professor at the University of Montana, and he also wrote a book called The Sacred Pipe, which is the sacred rites of the Oglala Sioux. The Oglala Sioux are my own home reservation, although I wasn't raised there. So I'm Lakota from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. And two last books that came out again, it's almost 10 years now. These books were written by the people who preceded me in my ministry. This book was pulled together by a woman named Marilyn Bodie. And this book, this is designed for Lutheran congregations, and it has a leader's guide, and it has a participant's book for every member, can be a good Bible study. The problem with this is that it did come out 10 years ago, and it is this book was put out directly in reaction to what we're going to talk about today, which is the Great Northwest Fishing War. This is a very complicated issue, and it is also a very Lutheran issue, because many of the fishermen in the Northwest are and were Lutheran people. I think it's fairly well done. It's one of the best books that's available to to begin with, I think, to begin a discussion. There is a text, and it's been newly revised. It's called Uncommon Controversy, which was written by the Friends, which gets into the subject of the Great Northwest Fishing War in a better way. And they just revise it, and I think either it's just out or going to be out soon, a new revision to Uncommon Controversy. I think the title is going to be Uncommon Controversy 2, to carry on from that issue. Okay. Before I begin, I want to know what you know a little bit about the Great Northwest Fishing War. You're from Olympia, we're off the Nisqually Reservation, so you may have heard more. You want
to? Well, I don't know, just judge bold decision. This seemed to change the whole way of the sport fishing industry in Washington. I think it's some of the commercial fishing, I guess.
Are you a sports fisherman?
No.
And a commercial fisherman?
No.
No, sport. And how has it affected you, your own life?
The way they keep the rivers closed and certain that open certain times for gillnetting. Well, of course, we said the custom ways used to just put hand nets and so forth. Now it's gillnet boats and gillnets and all that. So I don't know. It's just one of the things. It seems a lot less fish are caught now.
You catch a lot less fish. You see a lot less. Anybody else who has some connection with this?
Only as a former customer of the sports fishing charter fleet, the Waco charter fleet. I don't bother anymore because it was worth trouble to spend that much time and money.
Because you don't catch anything?
Well, even given two salmon, we travel that far.
Two salmon?
That's the best. It's too expensive. So in effect, I'm part of the public who's not patronizing the largely, I guess, maybe totally white charter fleet operation and causing its difficulties, if not a great deal of bankruptcies. And indirectly, I perceive that to be related to the whole decision, but I haven't said that. I haven't got any better.
There's no question about it. There's a tremendous cry of pain from the fishing communities all over the Northwest. And in the Northwest. And that's a reality. The question is, does that because of a treaty right situation or is it because of some other factors? Any other sort of place to begin on fishing rights? Where are you from?
You can start for me by telling what the bold decision is when you get started.
Okay,
I
will.
You know, there was one, and that somehow it got, the decision sort of settled it. For now, but I don't know what the facts were and what the decision was.
Okay. Where are you from?
St. Louis, Missouri.
St. Louis, Missouri. Okay, so this is a real important issue in the Midwest because it sets a framework for a debate that's going on now in Wisconsin. So I want to make some connections with that. Where are you from? Have you heard anything about this?
I just know that it's there. I really don't know anything about it.
Well, I'm from California also, and I was interested in this because of the situation in our rivers in Northern California, the Smith and the Clampett, those rivers too.
I've heard a little bit about that, some guns on the Klamath River. Some I've heard stories of people sort of shooting guns at Indians, and real controversy. Where are you from? Minnesota, that's right, I keep asking you. It's really important. There, we hear in Wisconsin that there are some signs going up, which are similar to the signs that went up at the beginning of the Bolt decision. There were signs in the Seattle and Tacoma and Nisqually area that you'd find under a railroad bridge or something. This is where I first started with the Bolt decision. I was driving along with my children, and I'm part Indian, and so my family was here. We're driving along and we see posters on railroad bridges and things that said, "Save our salmon, kill an Indian." And now we're seeing these same kinds of signs going up in the Midwest, "Save our deer, kill an Indian." It's pretty hard to explain to children what that's all about. It's a pretty difficult subject, and I'm really kind of frightened to even address it because it is so complicated, and you want to, you know, deal with it in a way that is helpful. So, I'm kind of leaning on the work that Joseph has done, because some of the materials that came out at the time are clearly biased one way or another. Depends on who wrote about it at the time. It was a very emotional and important issue. Let me just give you then some background in what the Bolt decision is. It's Joseph starts in 1961, and there were two Indian fishermen, Muckleshoots, and they had been raised in Washington State, and a Puyallup Indian who had been raised as a Muckleshoot. And in January of 1961, they set gill nets in the Green River. And the Green River is a river that flows out of the Cascades and through the southern part of Puget Sound. The next morning, after setting their gill nets, they came back to haul in their catch. They got one coho, which is a silver salmon. Suddenly, seven Washington game wardens with drawn revolvers burst from hiding places along the bank, and they arrested the three men for the double crime of, one, fishing out of season, and two, using a net. They were taken to a Seattle court and given suspended fines, $250 apiece. They were held in jail for 2 weeks until other Indians managed to bail them out. 2 weeks in jail for one salmon. Their cases were appealed, and 22 months later, in November of 1962, they were acquitted by Judge James Hodson in King County Superior Court. He decided that they had been fishing legally according to rights that were contained in a treaty which their ancestors had made with the federal government. Now, that one incident is just a place for us to begin. It had happened before throughout the Northwest, even and in Michigan and other parts of the United States. Fishing-oriented tribes had a history of tense and unsettled conflict with state and local officials, because their treaties gave them, and some of the people, you know, the elders had a way of telling the story, and there actually are people who are still alive who were there when the treaties were signed and who spoke the language of the people and taught their children what was told them and what was said, and so the elders had the understanding that the tribes had reserved the right to fish in their usual and accustomed places. And they had taught their children that. And at different times different places and different times, the individual native people would go out and exercise these rights. These are fishing rights that are not possessed by other people. The Muckleshoot case is special because it started, over a long time, Indians had been exercising those rights. But in 1961, it was like a beginning place for a very organized and sustained and determined drive by the state, Northwest states, and non-Indian sports and commercial fishing to end the concept of Indian treaty fishing rights in the Northwest once and for all. And that struggle began in 61 and lasted for years, and in fact, in my opinion, is not over. As the struggle reverberated back and forth, it became a very sensational struggle. And we had violent battles, we had hundreds of arrests, we had demonstrations, there were some very sympathetic celebrities. Some of you might remember Marlon Brando, Dick Gregory came out, and we got nationwide publicity and sympathetic to the Indian cause. There have been several cases in court, and in many cases, conflicting decisions. In other words, one court would rule one way, and another court would rule another way. And these court decisions have been the basis for the future of fishing rights, Indian fishing rights in particular. More importantly, almost, especially in a Christian context, the impact of the Great Northwest Fishing War has been so significant and historic. The whole controversy has given rise to an anti-Indian backlash, and that backlash movement has very strong political influence and continues today, as evidenced by the vote last year on what we called Initiative 456, which was denounced by all leading church bodies, and an incredible coalition of people, including the sports fishermen. And yet, a majority of the people in Washington State voted to pass an initiative which, in effect, asked the Congress to abrogate Indian treaty rights. So that's the strength of the backlash that has existed as a result of the Bold decision. The Bold decision, or actually this controversy even before the Bold decision, was touched on a match, that spread the flame of what became Indian militancy in the late 60s and in the early 70s. And those were the years when we heard things like Red Power. And there were the years then that this began the confrontations that led to the takeover at Alcatraz. How many of you have heard of that? The Indians took over the prison at Alcatraz, and they moved there and lived there almost a year, quietly were removed. They also took over the Bureau of Indian Affairs building in 1970, I forget, does anybody know? Three, I think. And you have also heard, have you, of the takeover at Wounded Knee? Okay. Does that ring a bell with most people? And it's interesting that this started out here in the Northwest, this move. To the Indians, to the non-Indians, also, but especially to the Indians, this has been a struggle for survival, and that's why I labeled this survival. This is part of a survival struggle. I think both sides experienced physical attack, jailings. The Indian side, there's one story to that that's really interesting, amazing to me as I read it. One of the things that happened is often when making an arrest, the state officials would confiscate the boats and the gear as evidence. Well, no boat ever was shown in court as evidence, but the Indians never got their boats back. Some of the boats that were lost, it's real interesting to me that some of the boats that were lost, confiscated, never returned, were the dugout canoes, the old ones, the ones that had been handmade and as you might imagine, have particular value in a museum type setting or something. It's kind of interesting aside that these people had been fishing out of some of these old boats for generations, and one of the results that I think has fed this hostility and pain that's also associated with this issue, the confiscation of the dugout canoes. It's real important for non-Indians to understand that those people who are involved in the Northwest fishing rights, those Indian people are considered patriots, heroes, culture leaders, very important people whose personality there is great pride and And that's real important to know that they're considered patriots by people not only in the Northwest but all over the United States.
And you say this is an issue related to survival.
Uh-huh.
I'm embarrassed to say that living right in the middle of that whole matter, I couldn't tell you on a bet how many Indians are involved. My perception is that it's a very small number relative to the national population, certainly, but more importantly, or more relevantly, to a number of other minority groups that are crying out in pain in one form or another, the blacks or the Hispanics, the Africans. Would you be addressing the numbers as a factor causing perhaps less appropriate reaction and sympathy to these issues by the whites than might be the case when they view the problems of larger minorities? Is that an issue?
Well, what you're lifting up is a real common approach to the issue of Indian rights. What the Indian people say that I've heard is that Indians are not an ethnic minority in the United States. The foundation for rights in Indian country has to do with a couple of things. One, the United States Constitution, that said that only the federal government could interact, trade with Indian nations. And the Constitution reserved the right to deal with Indians as a federal right, not a state right. The federal government, the United States government, recognized the Indian nations as sovereign nations, a conquered people. And in the process of settling a sequence which had begun with mutual coexistence, in the original homelands of the native indigenous peoples, non-Indians moved in and in the beginning shared. Later, that sharing degenerated to conflict, and that conflict most often degenerated to some kind of state of warfare. At the end of the period of warfare, they ended war by settling treaties. And that was the purpose of a treaty, to end war between the native peoples and the non-native peoples. In agreeing to a treaty, the native peoples reserved for themselves certain lands and rights in exchange for giving up the lands that they had previously lived and owned on. When the federal agents came to negotiate treaties, they presented Indians in ways that were culturally very different, the terms of treaties. And many times, treaties were made as a result of, it was sort of, you sign this treaty or else, kind of a thing, in many cases. No other ethnic group in the United States has, I won't say that, I'll take that back. Most of the other ethnic groups, the blacks, Asians, do not have that kind of relationship with the federal government. I took it back because there have been, and there were actually many treaties that were signed with Mexican people, federal treaties in the same way that were signed with Indian people. That fact hasn't been lifted up very much, but I have seen them and I have read them. And so some of the Mexican southwestern peoples also had treaties. In other words, in exchange for the land, they reserved for themselves certain land in many cases, they didn't get to choose which land would be, but land was reserved. And that gives them a unique status. There's another paragraph in here that talks about that issue too. In view of modern day realities, and I think you were talking about that, it seemed natural and justifiable to the whites to treat Indian fishers like everyone else, making them abide by state regulations as do the sport and the commercial fishermen. On or off the reservations, it seemed to the average person fair that they, being the Indians, should respect legal seasons and limitations of catch and employ the same gear that others were forced to use. And I think I've heard that here. But this is the Indians' statement. The Indians believe differently. Because of their special relations with the federal government, they insisted, first of all, state rules, regulations, and conservation measures did not apply to them when they fished according to their treaty rights. In other words, they understood their fishing rights to be the legacy that they passed on to their children. It's for Indian people, it's as though they made a contract with the United States government. We will sell you our land. We don't need your money. We need to fish. So that the payments for the land came in the form of the right to fish. This is the way it's understood, I think, by most Indian people. And this is the principle that was upheld in the Bolt decision by the United States Supreme Court. Secondly, the Indians maintained that the validity of their rights stemmed from the fact that their treaties, by which they had ceded lands, resources, and grants to the government, the treaties had specifically, and if you read them, and there's a good document that is in here, Washington State and Indian Treaty Rights, Facts and Issues, which was written by the League of Women Voters in Washington State, that really gives you a whole lot more information about that. And another one, the National Coalition to Support Indian Treaties also has a good handout on questions and answers on treaty rights, but that gets into more detail. The treaties define the nature of these special rights, fishing and hunting, which the government had granted them by act of Congress, and the tribes had clung to them, these rights, as property, never giving them away. Moreover, as the fish supply dwindled, the Indians felt aggrieved, knowing that their existence depended on fish. They felt that they had always practiced conservation, and they considered themselves abler and more dedicated conservationists than non-Indian fishermen. That may have been true in the beginning. I'm not exactly sure that you could just, you know, categorize. I mean, to me, that's a stereotype that says all Indians do one thing. That anything that says all anybody does anything is a stereotype. But this is what Josephy says. It's one of the problems with this book, and if you do read it, I think you need to read it knowing that he does tend to stereotype things a little bit. Okay. It was plain, and I think this is more important than anything else. The issue about Indians has much, much more to do with the pollution of the rivers, the dams that cut off access to spawning beds, and the preservation of the resource. And this is what has happened recently. Okay. Let me just finish this one paragraph. Constituting only a small fraction of the total number of fishermen, they not only balked, that is the Indians, at being made the scapegoat for the disappearing fish, but they complained that the commercial and sports fishermen, the non-Indian commercial and sports fishermen, were nullifying their treaty by depriving them of the fish to which they had a right. And they felt, by the same token, that they had the non-Indians had a treaty obligation to maintain a fish supply for them. So you see we have two people, two sets of people, coming from very different positions. And it is not an easy issue to understand. Go ahead.
Let me go back to the question. Acknowledging the difference between travel rights and perhaps labor arrivals on the scene and even whites in terms of fact and perceptions of whites. Correctly say that they are the smallest group of folks that whites generally as minorities. But for the point that the number of Indians that in fact are directly impacted, either livelihood wise or in any other way, families, whatever, by the fishing issue, further reduces that to a very, very small total. And is that not really why the whites generally are not more supportive and more concerned about this as a significant issue for Christian life? Well, that is doing something about, as opposed to worrying about a million Ethiopians dying as well.
Yeah.
What are the numbers? Do you have any feel for them?
In Washington State, it has been said that there are 60,000 Indians. Okay, now obviously 60,000 Indians, they are not all Indians who have traditional fishing rights. In many, many cases, the areas that they did fish traditionally no longer exist. The traditional runs are gone, totally. And the access to fishing in that area is gone. But there is behind that discussion of numbers and exactly how many. It's not one of the points that I wanted to make about numbers, though. In 1840, just in Puget Sound alone, there were more than 10,000 Indians. The number of Indian people, how many have survived, is directly related to policies and practices by the government. So that, who's to say how many Indian people would be here if it were not for the kinds of policies and practices that exist? So the numbers of people are also dependent upon history. But to go on with that, there is a principle here that this is an element that is clearly a part of a treaty. And Mary Jo Butterfield, who was on was at the time she said this, on the tribal council of the Macaw people, said, you have to also remember that the framework of the treaty is oftentimes the only thing that the tribe has to hold itself together and to continue to exist, and that when one part of the treaty is allowed to be altered, that sets out a principle which in fact may lead to the end of the treaty, which almost unanimously in Indian country, an abrogation of Indian treaties would lead to the end of the people. They have historical reasons to back that up. There is the experience in the 50s of a federal Indian policy, which we call termination, in which federal policy said reservations are keeping Indians out of the mainstream. This is the time when people were talking so strongly about the concept of a melting pot. The federal government said reservations are keeping Indians out. They can't melt in, so to speak, if we have a reservation. Let's terminate reservations, said Indian policy. It's very interesting to note that one of the results of terminating Indian reservations was a massive turnover of Indian-owned land to non-Indian hands. What they did, they had a policy called allotment, where they said for each individual, and it was the same thought that you just listed, here are these, how many left, maybe 50, 100 families of Indians on this great big piece of land. They're the only ones still alive. It isn't fair when all these other non-Indians are out there with their only acre or two. So So this is what they said in the 50s. So they allotted a section to each and then sold the rest as surplus, turned it over to non-Indian hands. Indians have found that it has turned out to be a way to take away what little heritage and legacy. This was a wealthy and rich, resource, wealthy land. And it only makes sense morally and ethically that the Indians should have shared some of the wealth that came from the wealth of this land. And in fact, it has not happened. That the legacy that has come down to them continues to be under attack in the form of things like Initiative 456 or congressional acts that threaten to abrogate Indian treaties. The remnant, the tiny little bit of what they had as a people is threatened. And so that's why this issue becomes a keystone and a turning for Indian people in terms of having a series of court cases that lifted up these principles, that here were people who gave up and lost so much, who have only this tiny heritage and legacy left, and the legacy is under attack. In this case, fishing rights, but in other areas, other things, whether it's land or water rights. Yes.
Is there a distinction made between fishing for sustenance or for commercial use involved here, or specific in the water rights?
In treaty language?
Right.
In the interpretation that was given with the Supreme Court statements on the Bull decision, as I understand it, it allows for a future, not so much that the people only can fish for what they personally need to eat to survive, but it recognizes that principle that the fishing life was one element of the legacy of the people, that being able to fish. And what the Bull decision said was that the treaty language that said that the Indian people would be able to fish in common at all usual and accustomed grounds and stations in common with all citizens of the territory. Judge Ball interpreted that to mean that the Indian people were entitled to 50% of what there was available to catch. And that is where the key turned, because, and I've heard some Indian people explain it this way. If there are two shares, equal shares, the number of Indian people who are catching the Indian share is a certain amount. But what happened in the Northwest is that the number of non-Indians, our state government issued fishing licenses, commercial fishing licenses, all of those things, to an increasingly large number of people. So many. And, you know, what someone said is, if we want to take 20 people to catch our share of the fish, what the non-Indians have done is taken 2,000 people to catch their share of the fish. And that's the reason for the devastation on their economy, because there was only so much fish to catch. The state itself did not limit how many people could do that. They kept giving out licenses until nobody could make a living catching fish like that. It seemed very unfair to the Indians that, having caught all the fish on their side, these 12,000 fishermen ought to be allowed to catch the Indian share. It is a misunderstanding that Indians, and the same group has another booklet called Don't Blame the Indians. Indians have been blamed for catching, for the decline. And I want to kind of get to that. What I want to say about this is, in my study of this whole issue, the most important thing for everybody to know is that the result of the work and controversy and conflict and back and forth, the result is that, to me, the most important issue is the resource has a chance now to survive. In 1960, when there was virtually uncontrolled fishing and uncontrolled pollution and uncontrolled dam building, the resource, the runs, were being totally decimated. And what's happened in the last couple of years is that after, and this is what the sports fishermen and commercial fishermen said, after 10 years of fighting in every way that we possibly could, we have decided that it's time to stop fighting, but work with the Indians to save the resource. And for me, as a person in ministry to the Lutheran Church, mostly non-Indians, and to the people of the United States, the lesson that comes out of the controversy that came to us in the Pacific Northwest is that our land is, for the most part, a non-renewable resource. Whether we're talking about fish, they are limited. There is only so many that we can catch at a given time without permanently destroying the resource. And what we have in the state of Washington now is a cooperative arrangement between all those people who are involved in using the resource. And they've all agreed that they must manage fish runs from gravel to gravel. That's really important, from gravel to gravel, from spawning to spawning, you know. Keeping the resource alive. And for me, that's the important issue that I try to teach to everyone, that our living resources, including human beings, are sacred and limited. And we cannot just simply work with them in ways that don't consider the impact down the road, not just to our own livelihood, but to the lives of our children and our great-grandchildren, down to the 7th and the 77th generation. In my series of teaching, we've talked about many different elements of that. We've talked about the land. We cannot use soil, as Master Fox would say. He's got the figures at the tip of his tongue better than I do. But what we're doing with the land is we're using it or polluting it. And when we pollute it, sometimes, in many cases, we're polluting it for 10,000 times 10,000 years. Just this last 2, 3, 4 weeks ago now, I've been up here a long time, Matthew Fox said we are destroying 10,000 species of life every 10 years. 10,000 forms of life that will never exist on the planet again. And there are those, if you see the slideshow on Saturday night called For Life, there is the possibility that we also have threatened our own existence as human beings, as a form, a species of life. It seems to me that the important thing that we can learn from the fishing war, there are a couple. One thing that is, for me, very important is that we have to understand that whatever happens between us, whatever is us, we and they, whether it's the United States and Russians, Indians and non-Indians, black and white, whoever. It seems to me that when we're in conflict with each other, we have to understand that the way to resolve that conflict is to begin with the idea that we're family with each other. That it's not an option to kill each other off. And that our relationships have to be based on a system of integrity. Now, in the Northwest, we still haven't responded adequately to the cries of pain of those people, those commercial fishermen, whose livelihoods, their lives have been destroyed. In the Midwest, we haven't taken care of those farmers whose livelihoods have been destroyed. It seems to me that in teaching, the principle which has proceeded in the history of the United States of not protecting the rights of a tiny minority, the Indians, it was said, I think it's by Chief Justice Marshall Cohen, I think that's his name. He said, the life of the Indian in America is like the miner's canary. And what isn't going right for Indians is a indicator of what isn't going right for the rest of us. And when our Indian people in this nation are dying out, it's only because the air is so poisoned that we are in a desperate place. And I think, as I've talked about land issues, water rights issues, human rights issues, we talked one day about racial stereotypes and the ways that we hate each other, that we create circumstances of we and they, and set up definitions which allow us to kill each other. These are all very important principles that have everything to do with ministry. A lot of Lutheran people are very interested in ministry in Central and South America and in Southern Africa. And it's very important for me to share with you that the rest of the world is very aware of our American history of relationship between Indians and non-Indians. And how can you understand the issue of apartheid and moving blacks onto reservations without knowing something about our own history in this country? And what kind of international credibility will we have? So these are really important connections. I think there's a tremendous connection between the fishing rights principle and what's happened to the farmers in the Midwest. The idea that I see some connections there between them. Is there anything you want me to address before we end?
I'm just back to the question of suggestions or thoughts about appropriate fixing position. I'm still troubled by the numbers from a workshop we had in touchdown. That is the needs of so many out there. I mean, so many hours in the day, so many dollars in the pocket, so many energy and courage for having to deal with. But we haven't reacted in food bank work. And we're looking at 300,000 people a month being essentially kept alive by the involvement of that wall, which was continued to continue to life for life. What would be a thought from you? How do you reorient those priorities? Those energy sources away. There's a finite amount of them available anyway. Is that an issue like this as a paramount issue? Whenever you want, you're looking at the side issue, survival issue. With the demand, by the way, there are such large numbers to deal with. How can we reconcile that problem with the concerns of, by your own words, a very small number of people?
What comes to my mind to answer you is the wonderful images that Dan Erlinger has visualized for us in a little document that he did this winter called Man of Spirituality. I believe that our Creator has provided an abundance. What is wrong in our world is that there are a few who take everything, and they have this little trickle to those. You know, the hungry and homeless in America should not be in competition with the hungry and homeless in Africa and Central and South America and the American Indians and other oppressed groups. The image that Dan has given, that Christians can join together, not trying to somehow allocate fairly an inadequate amount of the abundance of the creation that is left over after this group of people who are so over-consuming, are willing to share, you know, what they're willing to share. But the idea is that Christians join together with those who are oppressed and hungry to change the model, to teach all of us not to overconsume, because that is the real problem. The real problem is not scarcity, but overconsumption. It's in the bookstore. It's a little thing, and I don't know, it costs about 50 cents. Dan is here, and it'd be kind of good to talk to him about that. We need to go to dinner, and I think it is a pay fiction, and I think it has everything to do. The solution has to do with what we believe about our Creator. And in that line, I'd like you to stand and make a circle and say peace.